Chapter 8. Jesus. The first thought that occurs to me as I start thinking about Jesus is that I don't have any strong feelings about him, whether positive or negative. I would not go so far as to say he leaves me cold, but he certainly leaves me feeling rather lukewarm. In my early teen years, a particularly moving sermon by the pastor of the Baptist church I was attending could leave me with a heart overflowing with love for Jesus. Overflowing with love for Jesus. But by the time I reached home, the emotion would usually have evaporated, and I was never anywhere near, quote, accepting Jesus as my personal saviour, as it was called, as never even thought seriously about doing such a thing. One of the reasons why I don't have any strong feelings about Jesus is that I've never been able finally to convince myself that such a person as Jesus of Nazareth did once live as a man among men, whatever myths and legends may later have gathered around his name. At one time I would be convinced that Jesus was an historical figure, at another that he was not. It depended on which of the many books on the subject I happened to be reading just then. Thus, over the years, my mind swung back and forth between the two alternatives at least 4 or 5 times, though without my ever having an emotional investment in either of them. Eventually, I decided that it was more likely that Jesus had not lived than that he had, and this remained my position until fairly recently, when I happened to read about Marcion, the founder of Marcionism, who was active as a teacher in Rome between the years 150 to 160. His date of birth is unknown. According to Marcion, Jesus was a purely spiritual being who, descending from heaven, had suddenly appeared in Galilee in the 15th year of the reign of the Roman Emperor Tiberius. I was at once reminded of the beginning of the Gospel according to St. Mark. This Gospel, the oldest of the 4 Gospels that were to be recognised as authentic by the Catholic Church, begins by relating how Jesus came from Nazareth in Galilee to the River Jordan, there to be baptised by John the Baptist. That's from Mark 1, 9-11. It makes no mention of the antecedents of Jesus, or of what he was doing before he came from Nazareth of Galilee. There is nothing about his miraculous conception, as there is in 2 of the other Gospels. Nothing about the visit of the Magi. Nothing about the flight into Egypt. Nothing about the massacre of the innocents. For the author of Mark's Gospel, as more explicitly for Marcion, the life of Jesus began when he suddenly appeared, not necessarily from heaven, in the Galilean town of Nazareth, according to Mark, or Capernaum, according to Marcion. Mark's Gospel does, of course, refer briefly to the mother and brothers of Jesus, but Marcion would have regarded this as an example of the false Judaic traditions that had grown up around the apostles, on account of which he had been obliged to reject in toto the Gospels of Matthew, Mark and John, regarding as authentic only certain parts of the Gospel according to Luke. All this suggests to me that Jesus may in fact have appeared from somewhere outside Palestine, perhaps even from India or Central Asia. This is no more than a hypothesis, and Christians no doubt will reject it out of hand. But I, for one, find it easier to believe that Jesus may have come from somewhere outside Palestine than that he was born of a virgin and was God incarnate. Indeed, the possibility of his having come from somewhere outside Palestine makes it more likely, in my view, that Jesus had lived than that he had not. Some Christians will tell me that the truth about Jesus has been handed down within the church in an unbroken tradition since the days of the apostles, and that I ought, therefore, simply to accept its testimony that he was an historical figure. As a Buddhist, or even as a thinking human being, I cannot do this. Christians of another kind will tell me that if I were to study the 4 Gospels intensively, I would be convinced, in the end, that Jesus really had lived. For this I have never had either the time or the interest, or rather I would have found the time had the interest been sufficiently strong. But for me the question of whether Jesus had or had not lived was not a pressing one, for it had no bearing on my own spiritual life as a Buddhist. Nonetheless, I did once read Albert Schweitzer's In Quest of the Historical Jesus, a history of the critical study of the life of Jesus by a succession of 19th century German scholars, for whom the existence of Jesus was a matter of religious as well as scholarly concern. Some had discovered a rational Jesus behind the gospel narratives, others a liberal Jesus, and so on. Schweitzer himself opted for an eschatological Jesus, a Jesus who believed that he was the Messiah and that the world would come to an end within the lifetime of the disciples. He opts for a Jesus who escapes from history, a Jesus who cannot be known historically but only as a spirit within men. For Schweitzer, the quest for the historical Jesus had ended in failure, but that did not mean that it was devoid of value, for it had shown where Jesus was not to be found. Indeed, Schweitzer insists that it is impossible to overestimate the value of what German research upon the life of Jesus had accomplished. He goes so far as to call it, quote, a uniquely great expression of sincerity, one of the most significant events in the whole mental and spiritual life of humanity. This is a large claim and one which to some people will seem a little Eurocentric, not to say Germanocentric. The quest for the historical Jesus did not cease with the publication of Schweitzer's famous book. Though it seems not to have continued in Germany, it certainly continued elsewhere, if in academically less reputable quarters. In the course of the last 40 years, I have come across Jesus the Great Initiate, Jesus the Leader of an Uprising Against the Power of Rome, Jesus the Magician, Jesus the Socialist, the Aryan Jesus, the New Age Jesus, Jesus the Archetype of the Self, and the Extraterrestrial Jesus, who came from another planet and who returned there, thus explaining the ascensions. The list is far from complete, and I am sure that as time goes on, other Jesuses will be discovered, whether in the scriptures or in the depths of someone's imagination. Although I have never made an intensive study of the four Gospels, it was inevitable that in the course of my life I should have acquired some knowledge of them, either directly or through references to them in my general reading. One does not have to read the Gospels in order to know the parables. The literature of Europe is full of allusions to them. I cannot remember when I first read or heard such parables as those of the Good Samaritan, the Prodigal Son, and the Mustard Seed. It is as though I had drawn them in with my earliest breath. Some parables I came to know through paintings that illustrated them. I cannot even think of the parables as being essentially Christian. Many of them give expression to universal human values and are independent of their immediate context in this or that gospel. A few parables, such as that of the sower, have parallels in the Buddhist scriptures, the genre being one that was widespread in the ancient world. I regard the parables as part of my cultural heritage as a European, and I do not hesitate to make use of them in writing for or speaking to a Western audience about Buddhism. Just as one doesn't have to read the Gospels in order to know the parables, so one does not need to read them in order to familiarise oneself with the sayings of Jesus. These pithy utterances, too, are part of European literature. Such sayings as, "No man can serve two masters," "Judge not that ye be not judged," and "By their fruits ye shall know them," stuck in my mind, though I do not know when I first heard them or read them, and could not say offhand just where in the Gospels they are to be found. They stuck in my mind partly because they reached me in the language of the Authorized Version, which is more forceful, direct, and concise than that of more recent translations of the Bible. As the Buddha's poet disciple Vangisa chanted in the Master's presence, quote, "Truth verily is immortal speech," which I take to mean that truth is made memorable when it finds poetic expression. In the case of some of the sayings, I felt there was a living individual behind them, giving emphatic utterance to his thoughts and feelings. But whether that same individual was also behind all the other sayings, discourses, diatribes, and prophecies ascribed to Jesus by the authors of the four Gospels was quite another matter. Besides telling us what Jesus said, the Gospel also tells us what he did. One of the things he did was perform miracles, a miracle being defined in this connection as an effect above human or natural power performed in attestation of some truth. That's from Samuel Johnson's dictionary. The truth to which the miracles of the Gospels attest is that Jesus possesses divine authority. Most of the miracles are miracles of healing, the healing sometimes involving the casting out of a demon who has taken possession of the sick person. There are also cases of what we would call faith healing, as when a woman who had suffered from a hemorrhage for 12 years came up behind Jesus in the crowd and touched his garment, thinking that could she but touch his clothes, she would be cured. She was instantly cured, and Jesus told her, "Daughter, thy faith has made thee whole." That's from Mark 5:34. There was also the curious episode in which Jesus, on a visit to Nazareth, his hometown, was unable to work any miracle there, though he cured a few sick people by laying his hands on them. The author of the Gospels comments that Jesus, quote, "marvelled because of their unbelief," or, as a modern translation has it, "was amazed at their lack of faith." That's from Mark 6:6. Another class of miracles demonstrates that Jesus has power over the elements. He calms a storm, Mark 4:39-40, feeds 5,000 people with 5 loaves and 2 fish, Matthew 14:19-20, turns water into wine, John 2:1-11, and raises Lazarus from the dead, John 11:11-44. How do I, as a Buddhist, view these miracles? I certainly believe that there is such a thing as faith healing, a form of treatment, not, however, to be confused with spiritual healing, which takes place without the need for faith on the part of the patient. I therefore see no reason why Jesus, had such a person existed, could not have performed miracles of this kind. Unlike the authors of the Gospels, and unlike Christians down to our own times, I do not regard them as miracles in the sense defined above, and not, therefore, as attesting to the possession by Jesus or any other faith healer of divine authority. Similarly, I see no reason why Jesus could not have calmed a storm. The art of weathermaking is still known to certain Tibetan lamas, one of whom, a friend of mine, once told me that it was relatively easy to stop rain from falling on a particular spot, but quite difficult to conjure it from a clear blue sky. On the turning of water into wine, I have an open mind. There could be a natural explanation, Albert Schweitzer gives one, or alternatively it could have involved the use of psychic powers not unknown to the yogins of India and Tibet. The raising of Lazarus from the dead is a miracle of a radically different kind. So far as I know, it is beyond human power to bring back to life a man who is really dead, especially when he's been dead for 4 days, as Lazarus had, and, quote, "stinketh," John 11:39. It is possible for one to believe that Jesus literally raised Lazarus from the dead only if one believes that Jesus was God incarnate and as such had power over death. Since I cannot believe, as the Christian does, that Jesus was God incarnate, for as a Buddhist I do not believe in the existence of God, I cannot believe either that Jesus once brought a dead man back to life. The author of John's Gospel evidently included this miracle in his narrative, in attestation of the divine status and authority of Jesus. And it is significant that he chose to locate it shortly before Jesus' own death and resurrection. From debates about whether or not Jesus had really lived, and about the reliability or otherwise of the gospel narratives, I have at times turned with relief to Jesus as depicted in Christian art. The Christian artist believed in the existence of Jesus, just as he believed, as an artist, in the existence of the gods and goddesses of pagan antiquity, when, with the dawn of the Renaissance, he came to depict them too. He did not know what Jesus had looked like any more than he knew how Mars and Venus looked. In the Christian art of the 4th to the 12th centuries, there is in any case little attempt at realism. Attitudes tend to be stiff and hieratic, as they still are in Orthodox religious art. And Jesus is sometimes depicted as a beardless youth, as in the mosaics at Ravenna, sometimes as a bearded man of mature years, as in the mosaics of certain basilica churches in Rome. As art became more realistic, the artists attempted to give Jesus a consistent, recognisable individual character, as Duccio does in the panels illustrating the life of the Saviour in his Maestà in the Cathedral Museum of Siena, and as Giotto does to an even greater degree in his frescoes in the Arena Chapel in Padua. In the latter series, it is very much the same Jesus who attends the marriage at Cana in one fresco, and who in others raises Lazarus from the dead, enters Jerusalem riding on a donkey, and expels the merchants from the temple. He is a handsome, dignified man in the prime of life, with brown hair and beard. His expression is calm, his gesture hieratic. Even when being crowned with thorns, in another fresco, he remains impassive, simply half closing his eyes. It is only in the fresco of the crucifixion that, with eyes now closed and head fallen to one side, that he shows any sign of suffering, a suffering Giotto has the good taste not to exploit in the way some later artists were to do. With Masaccio, 100 years after Giotto, Jesus becomes more statuesque, occupying not two-dimensional but three-dimensional space, as do the disciples. He is depicted with them in Masaccio's finest work, his fresco in the Brancacci Chapel, Florence, illustrating the miracle of the tax money, part of which I saw when the chapel was undergoing restoration. The circumstances of the miracle are described in the Gospel according to St. Matthew, and only there, and were as follows. Jesus and his disciples were staying at Capernaum. There the collector of the temple tax asked St. Peter if his master paid the tax. When St. Peter told Jesus this, the latter directed him to cast a hook in the lake, take the first fish that bit, and open its mouth. There he would find a piece of money, which he was to give to the tax collector for the two of them. Matthew 17:24-27. In the fresco, Jesus occupies the centre of the composition. The disciples stand in a semicircle round him, and he is flanked by St. Peter on the left and by the tax collector on the right. Jesus, his right arm extended, points to St. Peter, who, extending his right arm in a vigorous gesture, which continues that of the master, points to a small, crouching figure at the extreme left of the fresco, who is taking something from the mouth of a fish. The small figure is St. Peter himself. Former Sacco has united the three parts of the episode in a single scene, the third part being that in which, at the extreme right of the fresco, St. Peter gives the money into the hand of the tax collector. The weakest part of the fresco, unfortunately, is the head of Jesus, now widely attributed to Masolino. One critic goes so far as to describe it as doll-like and lifeless, compared to the heads of the disciples. He finds it difficult, he says, to imagine Masaccio conceiving divinity in terms so mild and dreamy. But why did Masaccio not paint the head of Jesus himself, thus putting the finishing touch to his masterpiece? This was the question that puzzled me as I studied a small reproduction of the fresco. Did Masaccio die before he was able to complete his fresco by painting the head of Jesus? Or did Masolino insist that he, as the older and more experienced artist, ought to do the work? So far as I'm aware, there is no evidence to support either of these theories, though it is known that Masaccio died young, at the age of 26, not in Florence but in Rome, allegedly by poisoning. My own explanation of the mystery is not circumstantial, but psychological. According to the critic to whom I have referred above, the head of Jesus in the fresco is doll-like and lifeless compared to the heads of the disciples. The latter are, in fact, very finely portrayed. This is particularly true of the head of St. Peter. His hair and beard are grizzled. The corners of his mouth are turned down, and he glares rather than looks at Jesus. He is evidently an irascible old man, and one possessed of great force of character. Masaccio seems to have seen into St. Peter's soul. He must have asked himself what sort of man St. Peter was. He must have pondered deeply on those passages in the Gospels and in the Acts of the Apostles, where the saint plays a part, and then have portrayed him in accordance with the impression he received. Why, then, did he not do the same in the case of Jesus? My belief is that he wanted to do so, but found he was unable to see into the soul of Jesus as he had seen into St. Peter's. The four Gospels do not give, between them, a very consistent picture of the character of Jesus, and Masaccio must have found it no less difficult to make up his mind what sort of man Jesus was than have many others since his time. The question was complicated by the fact that Jesus was not just a man. For Masaccio, as a Christian, Jesus was God incarnate, the Word that had been made flesh and had dwelt among us. How could such a being be portrayed? An artist of Masaccio's genius could not be content simply to portray Jesus as other artists had portrayed him. He must therefore have thrown down his brushes in despair and left the work of painting the head of Jesus to Masolino. There is perhaps a more prosaic explanation of the mystery. It may be that Masaccio was accustomed to paint from the live model. With the growth of realism in art, the practice must have been fairly widespread by this time. Perhaps Masaccio painted his portraits of the disciples from beggars he brought in from the street, just as El Greco, two centuries later, painted his portraits of the disciples from the inmates of the local lunatic asylum, and perhaps he had been unable to find anyone from whom he could paint the portrait of Jesus. Though the artists of the Renaissance and the Baroque period might idealise the features of the models from whom they painted their biblical personages, the latter often show traces of the national or regional provenance of their real-life originals. Thus we have virgins who are really Italian peasant women holding a fat Italian baby, and Jesuses who are really Spanish patricians in Oriental costume. Nowadays we also have the blonde, blue-eyed Nordic Jesus and the almond-eyed Chinese Jesus, who, as I recently saw, rides into Jerusalem on a donkey to be welcomed by the city's almond-eyed inhabitants. There are also those artists who sought, with or without the help of a model, to penetrate into the character of Jesus, as I believe Masaccio had wanted to do. Leonardo da Vinci was such an artist, his genius being one that delighted in exploring what was mysterious and unfathomable. Though it seems he hardly ever drew or painted the adult Jesus, it is the figure of Jesus that occupies the central position in what is probably his greatest work, the wall painting of the Last Supper in the refectory of Santa Maria delle Grazie in Milan. Jesus has just told the disciples that one of them will betray him. Luke 22, verses 21-23. And Leonardo shows them reacting in their different ways, each in accordance with his individual character. He sits with arms spread wide, hands resting palms uppermost on the table. His head is turned a little to one side, and his eyes are half closed. There is no halo, but his head, with its long hair, is framed by the rectangular window immediately behind him. Time has not dealt kindly with the painting, and it is not easy to see what Leonardo made of the character of Jesus. Moreover, according to Vasari, Leonardo did not perfect the head of Jesus, as he could not find a model that could express, quote, that beauty and celestial grace. However, there exists in Milan a pastel head of Jesus that appears to be a study for the Last Supper. So expressive is it of that beauty and celestial grace for which Leonardo sought, that I find it difficult to believe that Leonardo drew the head from the model, however much he might have idealized the features. Leonardo must have sought and found that beauty and celestial grace in the depths of his own soul. There are those artists, again, who were concerned not so much to penetrate into the character of Jesus as to depict the main incidents of his life in as dramatic a manner as possible. One of the most eminent of these was Tintoretto. The paintings in which he tells the gospel story from the Annunciation to the Ascension are the glory of the Scuola di San Rocco in Venice, and the fullest expression of Tintoretto's extraordinary genius. Some paintings contain dozens of figures and much movement, and Tintoretto breaks many compositional rules, so that at first glance it is difficult to make out what is happening, as I found when I visited the Scuola 20 or more years ago. I nonetheless have the distinct recollection of two of the paintings, one depicting the temptation, the other Jesus before Pilate. In the first painting, there are only two figures. Jesus is seated at the top right under the dark, unevenly projecting beams of what appears to be a roof. His head is surrounded by a mild luminescence, against which his features show in profile. From the bottom left springs a young, epicene Satan, mockingly holding up two stones, one in each hand, tempting Jesus to turn them into bread. The other painting contains a number of figures, but it is the slim, silent figure of Jesus that dominates the scene. Wrapped in a white mantle that trails down the steps, he stands like a column of light against a dark architectural background, his head bowed. A red-robed Pilate, seated in the shadows a step or two higher than Jesus, washes his hands of responsibility for the prisoner's death, which has been loudly demanded by the assembled Jews with shouts of "Crucify him!" Mark 15:12-14. Several films of the life of Jesus have been made, but I've seen only one of them. This was Pasolini's The Gospel According to St. Matthew, with background music from Bach's St. Matthew Passion, which I saw shortly after its London release. Pasolini was said to be a devout Roman Catholic, but I could more easily have believed him to be a militant atheist. As I commented afterwards to the friend with whom I saw the film, it was as though Pasolini was saying, "Look, I've told the story of Jesus as convincingly as I could, sticking close to the gospel narrative, but how can anyone believe it?" Besides encountering Jesus in churches and art galleries, and at the cinema, I also encountered him in literature. When I was 16 or 17, I read Sholem Ash's The Nazarene, a novelistic version of the life of Jesus written from a Jewish point of view. It was a substantial work, but all I can remember of it is the passage in which Jesus, on a visit to a cosmopolitan coastal city, is shocked by the nudity he sees there, an illustration of the difference between Hellenic and Hebraic culture. Much more recently, I read George Moore's The Brook Kerith, which likewise is a novelistic version of the life of Jesus. Beautifully written from the standpoint of a non-believer with a sympathetic interest in modernist theology, it is one of the Irish author's finest works. The Jesus of the Brook Kerith is an Essene, a member of a Jewish sect or brotherhood that lived in the region of the Dead Sea, practicing asceticism and awaiting the coming of the Messiah. Next to Jesus, the most important character in the novel is Joseph of Arimathea, with an account of whose early history the story begins. Though strongly attracted to the miracle-working preacher who claimed to be the Messiah, about whom he has heard from the fisherman who worked for his father, a pious Jew in the fish-salting trade, he does not become a disciple, as he is reluctant to sell all that he has and give the proceeds to the poor, as Jesus demands. Instead, he carries on his father's fish-salting business and becomes friends with the cultivated ruler of Roman Palestine, Pontius Pilate. Thus, he is in a position, a few years later, to rescue the body of Jesus from the cross for burial. Late that night, to Joseph's astonishment, the body shows signs of life. Jesus has not died on the cross, but he is severely traumatized, and it is many months before the careful nursing of Joseph and his woman servant restores him to health. Moore's lengthy description of Jesus' gradual recovery is not only very convincing, but extremely moving. From Joseph's house, the erstwhile Messiah returns to the Essene monastery beside the Brook Kerith, from whence he originally came, and shortly afterwards Joseph himself is murdered by a zealot, a fanatical anti-Roman Jewish nationalist. But though physically healed, mentally Jesus is in a state of shock. He remains in that state for 15 years, saying little and living mainly by himself as an Essene shepherd in the hills. When he finally emerges from his silence, it is with the realization that his messiahship was a delusion and his former teaching harsh and cruel. At this point, some 20 years after the crucifixion, Paul appears on the scene. He is on his way to Rome, having been arrested for causing a riot in Jerusalem and having appealed, as a Roman citizen, from Jewish law to the law of Rome. His guard has granted him leave from prison while he is waiting for the ship that will take him to Rome for his trial. But he and his companion are pursued by a band of zealots, and Paul, separated from his companion in the night, finds refuge in a cliffside cave with the very sect of Essenes that has for shepherd Jesus of Nazareth. There he harangues the Essenes at great length, telling them how he was a Jew of scrupulous orthodoxy, how he cruelly persecuted the Christians, as the followers of Jesus of Nazareth were called, how that same Jesus appeared to him in a vision, and how, since then, he has travelled the world proclaiming the joyful tidings that Jesus Christ, who was crucified under Pontius Pilate, was raised by God from the dead, and that only through faith in him could anyone be saved. When Jesus arrives later and assures Paul that he did not die on the cross, Paul does not believe him. His Jesus and the shepherd Jesus are not the same man, he thinks, though both come from Nazareth, and in any case, Jesus is a common enough name. The following day, when Jesus guides Paul through the desert to a point from where he can see the port, which is his destination, he again tries to convince him that there is only one Jesus of Nazareth, that he is that Jesus, and that he did not perish on the cross. But this time Paul thinks he must be out of his wits, or that he is a demon come to tempt him. However, he asks Jesus what thoughts came to him in the hills, and Jesus tells him. Shortly after they part, Paul sees people in a strange garb going towards the hillside on which he has left Jesus. They are monks from India, a shepherd informs him. Paul sees the likeness between the thoughts Jesus has confided to him and the shepherd's account of the doctrines that were being preached by the monks from India. The monks will meet Jesus in the valley, Paul muses. Quote, and if they speak to him, they will soon gather from him that he divined much of their philosophy by watching his flock, and finding him of their mind, they may ask him to return to India with them, and he will preach there. End of quote.